As you know, the On Farm podcast is brought to you by the team at Seen and Heard PR and Marketing, and I just wanted to remind you about a new initiative that's happening here called On Record. On Record is a project to preserve voices, stories and memories for the future with your very own audio recording. So we're recording memories of rural life. We're travelling around Scotland, working with families and organisations to capture precious voices of family members or staff members or long-serving office bearers to preserve those for posterity and sometimes for historical value. So if you think this project is something that you'd like to be involved in, and maybe you have a grandparent or a parent that you'd like to capture on audio while you can, please do get in touch. You can find out more at onrecordmemories.co.uk.
It's Monty here for this episode of On Farm, the Food, Agriculture and Rural Matters podcast. It's nice to be back with you. This episode is made in conjunction with our friends at Bellingham, and I believe it's a must-listen for anyone interested in community projects, castles, and the restoration of historic buildings. Coming up, we'll chat with the builder, architect, and one of the community champions responsible for the restoration of Braemar Castle.
It was a rather sad-looking exterior. It was very dour, sombre, grey structure with bits of render falling off.
You're starting to see the chimneys appear now and you're starting to get a sense of what it's going to look like, but I think we'll all take a great sense of pride once we see it down and, you know, it's scuffed away, and because it's now lime washing, it's got a bit of colour about it again. It's a lot more vibrant than what it was before.
It's a case of a small rural community trying to be a bit more self-sufficient.
This one's got history, community benefit, traditional skills, and all with a lovely coating of traditional Scottish lime wash. Just to say, before we get into the meat of the episode, this will be the first of two episodes we recorded in Braemar with the team at Bellingham. Look out for episode two coming soon.
I'm Ian Cram, I'm a partner with Bellingham. We are fundamentally a jobbing firm of architects and planners and building surveyors. Obviously, as part of Bellingham, we're a rural organisation, so we look after buildings in the countryside. Quite a few of us have, I dare say it could be called an obsession, with looking after old buildings.
We're standing here in the grounds of Braemar Castle. We're standing with the castle behind us here. Tell me more about why Bellingham involvement in this castle? What's been happening?
We were invited to tender for the work of the architectural project at Braemar Castle several years ago. It's been a long, slow gestation period because obviously they need a scope of works developed to establish what needs to be done prior to fundraising for what can be done. There's a phase of work that has to go in at the start where you narrow down everybody's aspirations and desires for the project, get it to a realistic, affordable, fundable scope of works, because different funders have different interests and passions, and therefore that may influence what you can and can't do.
So, i.e. in terms of traditional architecture and historical aspects?
Or it may be to do with the community organisation, somebody that's willing to support them because it's owned by the or managed by the community. Other people will be willing to fund it because it's a building of historical significance. So you've got to pool together all the different funding sources and all the different aspects of the work, working with a diverse team of consultants that will assist and support the information. And then it's a case of submitting the grant applications. A tremendous amount of hard work, fundraising, mainstream fundraising, until such a time where you can see that the project is achievable and deliverable. And then at that stage, you have to start narrowing it down and saying, right, what are we going to have to spend? What are we going to do? And prepare a scope of works so that we can get contractors on board to price the work. And it's only once you get the prices in from the contractor that you actually know what you can afford to do. And then you go through the same process all over again knowing what the real prices are, saying this is what we can and can't afford.
So the castle just now is covered in scaffolding. We can see that the rough cast, the lime wash is going on. What has been happening? What's behind that new, if you like, exterior that we can see? What else has been going on? What was the castle like when you came along, and what's happened to get it to this stage?
Well, if we go back 3 years, it was a rather sad-looking exterior. It was very dour, sombre, grey structure with bits of render falling off, an appearance that is commonly associated with castles in Scotland. The challenge was to breathe new life into it, to bring it back to what it once was. So all the cement render that was damaging to the building had to be carefully removed, largely by hand, to take it off, to make sure that we didn't damage the structure, and to clear away all the traces of the cement coating that was... Cement will rot a stone building if you leave it too long, and that was certainly a serious danger here. So we had to take it back for probably the first 3 to 4 months of the job was going backwards. And then we get into the exciting stage of building up the layers of lime wash and lime render to restore it. As you will see today, the upper sections are in their final coat, final colour. Some of the lower stages still looking a little bit patchy and blotchy, so they've still got to get their top coats on. But we're almost at the ground now, so it's really exciting to see the scaffold starting to come down.
My name is Doreen Wood, and I'm the Vice Chair of Braemar Community Limited, who look after Braemar Castle on behalf of the local community. Well, it's a 1.6 million restoration project. We are very grateful to Heritage Lottery Fund and to Historic Environment Scotland, and also to the local community and all our friends and benefactors who have donated the remaining 500,000. Well, we're not quite there yet. We're nearly there. We're still about 90,000 short. So if anyone's got a pound in their pocket, we'd be pleased to hear from them. So we took over the castle in 2007 from Invercold Estate. It wasn't in great state. It had been closed for a number of years. There was a huge amount of work needed done. And in 2008, we worked and worked, and we eventually reopened to the public. And over the years have gradually built up a very successful community business. We started with 2,500 visitors. When we closed before the restoration started, we were up to 14,500 visitors. So it's a real success story for a small community of 400 people.
You've all come together as a community to do this.
Yes. Braemar Community Limited is the driving force, and we have a board. The community have a great love and enthusiasm for the castle, and they... People just come and go, and they do what's comfortable for them. Some people guide, some people work in the shop, some people work in the garden, some people just come and pick up litter. Everything. And of course, you know, we have celebrations because this is something really worth celebrating, and we bring people together, and it's been a great community venture.
The history and the community asset, etc., that's why you're doing what you're doing here in terms of the work. Do you want to just talk us through what's happening here at the moment? Tell us a bit about going on.
The castle came to us in a fairly shabby condition. The harling was falling off. There were cracks in the curtain wall. It was broken. The roof was letting in water. So the first thing we did was we raised funding to have the roof repaired, which was the first 500,000 that we raised. So that was done a number of years ago. And we've been trying to build funding, but you know, we will never have enough money on our own to actually do this sort of work. So we're incredibly grateful to our funders to allow us to do this, and there is work to be done inside the castle at the moment. We're, you know, repairing the electrics, we're doing the basic stuff, but we don't have enough money just to do everything we would like to do. But that'll come later, because once we reopen, hopefully the visitors will flow again and money will start flowing into the coffers, and we'll build up that fund. Braemar Community Limited functions on behalf of the community to manage community projects. Mm-hmm. So the money doesn't go to Braemar Community Limited, it goes to to fund other projects in, yeah, in the village. For okay. example, we had a hydro fund, a hydro scheme going at Corrimoolsey, which Braemar Community Limited began, but it's now been set up as a separate enterprise, and it has community shareholders and feeds money back into the village. So it's a case of a small rural community trying to be a bit more self-sufficient.
I like the idea of that, and it's, you know, every rural community needs to look at, you know, things that they can do for renewables and things that they can do for the greater good of the community. But you're so lucky with this flagship asset here to almost to kind of pump prime that. Is it, has it been like that? Has it almost been like a sort of rallying point as well?
Yes.
to bring people, and then once you've got them together, it's like, oh, we could do a hydro scheme, or we could do something else. Is that
the castle is obviously an obvious thing for people to get stuck into, so it has been a rallying call for people. I mean, as I say, we're a tiny community, but we have on the castle, we've got 80 volunteers, which is extraordinary out of a community of 400.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And before you had to close for this work, what was the sort of offering? What were people seeing? They were coming here to visit. What was, you know, what's the inside?
Well, the castle has such an amazing layers and layers of history, as I say. So there are 12 fully furnished rooms, and people are surprised because, particularly when we had a scruffy castle, they would come up the path and think, well, there'll not be much inside. And they were absolutely taken aback by the content, the fully furnished rooms, and the vibrance of the inside of the castle, because it looked like a dull place to visit. And then, of course, you know, add on to that the incredible stories and layers of history that the castle has seen. And it just is an amazing asset for the community.
Layers of history because of its situation as a, you know, on routes through the Highlands here, or?
Well, the castle was built in 1628 by John Erskine, the Earl of Mar. He built it as his Highland hunting lodge. Following the Earl of Mar, it was then used as a garrison in the years after Culloden by the Redcoats. So they were here for quite a number of years. It then became a Victorian party house. The chief of Clan Farquharson owned it, and they would hold lavish parties. People would come because of Queen Victoria, of course. Mm-hmm. Deeside became a really, really attractive location.
It was the place to be.
So people flooded from London and from the south, and they would gather here for these lavish parties. So we've got marvellous story. We have got a wonderful archive in the castle, which is such an incredible asset. And at the moment, we have one of our volunteers who is an archivist, and she is digging into all the old archive papers, writing up the stories. So we had done a bit of research previously, but now we'll have even more information about what went on in the castle. So it's just, we are so fortunate to have a building. So many castles have one family and one story.
Yeah.
We have layers and layers of history. We're very fortunate.
Yeah. And I suppose very fortunate with all of that history, all of that story to tell, but you're kind of telling it on behalf of the community, you're telling it for the benefit of the community, and, you know, what's generated here goes back into preserving it for the community.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. Mm. We're so fortunate. We're so fortunate that the estate agreed to hand it over to us. Nobody wanted to buy it. We had a benefactor who prefers to remain anonymous, but the furniture was all going to be sold, and it was going to Sotheby's to be sold at auction. But we were very, very fortunate because the benefactor bought all the furniture.
Okay.
So none of the furniture moved, so the castle looks exactly as it did, which visitors really enjoy.
Yeah.
Empty rooms are not nearly so much fun.
No, empty rooms or your interpretation of what it may have looked like or whatever, whereas this is genuine, right? What's the time frame now, Doreen? What are we seeing, and when are we seeing the scaffolding down, etc.?
The plan is that we reopen the castle in August this year,
okay,
but on a limited basis, and then next year we'll do a grand proper opening. But we've got systems to test. Obviously, we're investing in new booking systems, new security system, everything. So there'll be a lot of testing going on this year, but we will reopen. But it's going to be incredibly exciting to see the scaffolding come down.
In terms of that, in terms of community benefit, you know, having this here, it must make visitors stop. They come to the castle and then they go into Braemar and spend money there in shops, hotels, etc., as opposed to, oh, isn't this pretty? I wonder where Balmoral is. I wonder where, you know, and just keep going up the road. This is an anchor point to help people to stop here.
Exactly. And we've improved the grounds as well. We've put in new paths. The old kitchen garden we will plant. You know, you're building and building and building the reasons why people should visit Braemar, which is brilliant.
I'm Stephen Harper, Director of Stonemason for Harper Nolan Masonry. We are the main contractor for the project here at Braemar Castle. We've been on site from about November 2021. We're now approaching sort of latter stages of the project and hope to be finished by the end of July, because I think they're looking to have a soft opening of the castle then. So I think we're on schedule. You know what, like, it's a bit of a gallop to the end as normal with these projects, but I think we're nearly there. So,
well, I mean, to be fair, Stephen, I don't know. Have you done many castles? This looks exciting for you.
Yeah,
you do castles.
I mean,
what do you do?
Yeah, I've probably only done a full castle maybe once or twice in my sort of 25-year career, so they don't come along projects like this very often. So, yeah, it's a bit unique, shall we say.
And exciting to be involved in.
It is, aye, yeah. It is. Here as well, it's sort of the location of it as well. You know, you're kind of in Braemar, pretty much in the Cairngorms, I think, here as well. It can be fantastic in the summer and it can be brutal in the winter with the temperatures, which obviously affects what we are doing here as well. Hence why the scaffolds stayed up so long here. All the Harland, Lyme Harland works were actually done last year, but we kept the scaffold up throughout the winter just to give the new Harland some protection for its first winter, because with the Lyme Harland, it takes a bit longer to sort of carbonate and set up than, say, a cement wood, for instance. That would be almost instant, whereas this takes months, if years, to sort of set.
So talk us through what you've had to do, because it's, as you say, it's a very traditional way of doing things. You know, you stripped off and you got back to bare stone.
So, well, we came in, the first thing we'd done was get the scaffold up. I think it was about December time. So then we had sort of January and February in the cold weather to remove the old cement harland that was on the walls. Remove that, and then...
Pleasant up there in a February day.
Oh, jeez, it had been cold. Like, well, actually, we were quite fortunate because the January, some of the weeks were some of the warmest January days we'd had, because the guys were sort of working in T-shirts. Well, the paper came up with saying 40 years ago today, I think it was some of the coldest temperatures recorded ever in Braemar, and we were going about in T-shirts, so we're quite lucky then. But yeah, we took off that, and then about this time, about April, May last year, is when we started putting on the Harland coat. So it's like four what we call lime harland applications. So once it's back to the bare masonry, we put on a real thin coat over the top of it, what we call like a pricking up coat. It's almost like a bonding coat for the back. And then we fill out any voids in the wall with sort of small pinning stones and that as well, because you don't want to build up too much bits with mortar, because it'll just be a sponge crack and potentially fail. And then after that, we do like a straightening coat and then a hand cast finish coat, which is the finish you see on the top surface. So it's all sort of done by hand. And then once we've done the four coat harald application, then we put six coats of lime wash on the top. And lime wash is just watered down lime, and that's applied with brushes on the wall as well, and there's six coats of that with a slight, it's got pigment through it as well, give it its colour. That's the colour that you see on the top. So
when you're talking about this, and you're talking about, you know, your four coats and your this and whatever, I mean, you're kind of, what you're really referring to is an age-old craft of doing that.
That's apart from maybe, obviously, we've maybe got the hoist to get things up the scaffold and that now, modern stuff, like they sort of, the process is very similar to what it would have been back in the day. That's correct, yes.
Does that make you feel proud? It's not about just going and buying bags of cement that have come from wherever and what, you know,
it's it's stonemasonry and projects like this, they're very self-satisfying, you know, when you can see what everybody's done, we've all done as a team. It's very rewarding and satisfying, and you know, everything's sort of mixed by scratch. So over to your right here, you can sort of see we've got a sort of mixing area so we've got our sand underneath the tarpaulin there, we've got, you know, our chips for the final coat mix and that there, we've also got a couple of different limes that we use as well. So it's It's almost like the kitchen, you know, you've got all your ingredients there and that's where everything's cooked up. That's like the site kitchen, basically.
Talk to us about that, because Lyme Harling, you know, a lot of our listeners are probably in older buildings on farms, etc. And Lyme Harling is... That's the way the Scottish buildings were finished. That's correct. And it's the right way to do it, is that
correct?
Right?
Correct, yes. Traditionally, buildings were built with sort of lime mortars, and it would have been lime kiln set up locally in the area where they would get pieces of limestone and burn it down to make mortars, etc. It wasn't until probably after around about the Second World War when cement was more mass-produced, because they needed a lot of buildings put up very quickly, so that was when cement more came into use. And then they started using it for, say, like sort of repairing buildings like this and that as well. And it was probably not until maybe the 70s and 80s, after that sort of 20, 30 year period, that they realised the damage that putting cement, you know, non-breathable coatings on the external face of the building, the damage it was actually doing. So in the last sort of 15, 20 years, we're trying to reverse that a bit by using lime mortars and that again, which are breathable and softer on the building.
Because you've got old stone and you've got lime as the mortar.
Yes.
And it's a lot of these buildings, it's that's a busy A93, the tourist route that was beside here. And there's a procession of older cars there as well, I think. But it's not the conception, you know, you might go into Aberdeen, for example, and the buildings are all lovely dressed granite. But you come out into rural Scotland and a lot of buildings were just rubble stone, really, fieldstone, isn't it?
Exactly. It's whatever was at hand and local, you know, because back when a lot of these places were built, you would just take from your nearest source. So a lot of the stone for instance, a lot of the rubble stone would have just been sort of field stone.
Or out the river. Or,
exactly, just really locally sourced, so they wouldn't have to go far to sort of take it up to site and
so
that.
So then when you build with that, it needs to be harled or something finished off.
Basically, the harling is like it's like an extra skin, an extra protective layer for the masonry on the outside face of the walls. It's just like a protective, because obviously here it's very exposed as well. We're sort of sat on top of a little bit of a hill here, and you've got the sort of glen coming down, so you're getting all the winds coming down the hill. So it's just a harling is basically a sort of extra sort of weathering.
Weatherproof.
To protect the building.
And the lime mortar would get washed out or whatever otherwise, is that how?
Yeah. And then water might penetrate through because you'll have your stones, and in between the stones you'll have your sort of bed mortar, etc. Yeah. And with this being granite, if it was just, you know, exposed granite, it'd put a lot of pressure on just that mortar joint, and then maybe eventually, with the amount of driven rain you have here, it would just wash out a bit, as you say, then make its way in. So this just gives it an extra kind of protective layer.
So you've done it the right way. After the advent of modern cement, etc., people started cladding these buildings in cement, which is a disaster, is that?
Yeah, it can be, because, you know, cement, it's not a flexible material, and these old buildings, they still move ever so slightly, but, you know, when you've got, say, a cement render on there, it can lead to a bit of movement, then a crack appears. And because the cement is so hard and dense and not breathable, moisture can get in through that crack and it can get in behind. But once it goes in behind, it can't really come back out the way, so it tends to want to go in the way. So like say here, they had a cement sort of harling on and cracks, water getting in behind. And I think the humidity levels on the inside caused concern for the collections on the inside as well, you know, because the humidity levels went up with
If you're not looking after the outside, you're letting basically moisture ingress and it's ruining what's inside.
I mean, these old buildings, especially when you've got collections and that in the outside, it's imperative that you sort of maintain the outside. I mean, even once we've done this, we'll have to still maintain it. It's not a case of let's do a big project, we've done it, now we can forget about it for 25 years. You've got to do your annual maintenance checks on it. Stuff like making sure your gutters aren't blocked, because once that gutter blocks, that causes a lot of problems down below in that as well. So,
how do you price for a job like this? Because there must be so much that you don't know until you get.
There is. I mean, experience, you know.
There's a real builder sucking of teeth there, aren't
I? It's experience. And to be fair, I was quite lucky because I was involved with this project before it actually got tendered out for the main works here, and we'd done quite a lot of trials on the castle, so we cut out sections of the old harling just to sort of get an understanding of the substrate behind it, and then we'd done trials with the mixes and that as well. So when it came to pricing it, everybody had the same information and we had an idea of what, you know, the project was going to be. But, you know, these old buildings, there's always surprises, you know. You can do your best investigation works beforehand, but there's always stuff that once a scaffold's up there, you've got good up and close access, you always seem to find.
Did you find anything? Did you find any horror stories or interesting things or, you know, oh God, we better sort that before we go any further type moments?
I wouldn't say horror stories. There's things like the roof on the west elevation. It wasn't down for being stripped and re-slated, but once we got a closer look, it was in quite a bad state, so that had to be stripped and re-slated. But apart from that, no, nothing to lose sleep over anyway, I don't think. Not for me personally, anyway.
Relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
Not too bad. How will you feel in August or whenever the castle's open and people are parked out here and walking up? And
I mean, even now, there's some of the scaffolds starting to come down at the top. All the scaffolds now off the roof at the top, and you're starting to see the chimneys appear now, and you're starting to get a sense of what it's going to look like. But I think we'll all take a great sense of pride once we see it down and, you know, the scaffold away, and compared to what it was before, because it's now lime washing, it's got a bit of colour about it again. It's a lot more vibrant than what it was before.
Because
it was sort of cement, so it wasn't coloured, it was just really dark and you know, shall I say, depressing looking. But now it'll be a lot more vibrant, and it'll be, you know, quite a thing on the landscape now. So
I'm sure you'll come and visit.
I will do, yes. I will do. No, I'm looking forward to coming along once it's all done, because we've still got a bit of groundwork to do round about the grounds. You see all these new paths coming up, that's all newly put in as well, but this area we're standing in here was the old sort of like a car park, but this is all getting resurfaced and that with gravel and that, and there's stuff to do around the back there too, so there's a little bit to do, and then we'll look forward to it being done.
Good.
We better stop hindering the man, he's got a lot to do.
you're
like a crack on.
Brilliant, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Yeah. It's about rural communities looking at what's on their doorstep and how they can make more of it to attract that tourist pound. And the last thing you want to be is just a highway passing
Absolutely.
Through.
It's about visitor management as well. It's about creating car parks, places for people to park comfortably so they don't annoy the locals. It's about being welcoming, which is really important. And, you know, there's a lot of space around Braemar. Yeah. There really is plenty of room for everybody, for all these interests, the walkers, the historic buffs, all of that. There's plenty of space for everybody, but it does have to be managed, and the community are trying to do that.
Doreen, to what extent is this a model for other rural communities around Scotland? We've been hearing a lot about, you know, community buyouts of assets, whether that's the Isle of Egg or Langham or those kinds of places. Have you got people ringing you up and saying, how did you do that?
Not yet, but we were, I believe, the first castle to be taken over by a local community. It's an amazing opportunity for a community, but maybe not every community would want to do it. But there's been a real enthusiasm.
Yeah, but look at what it's cost you. You know, financially, the hard work. Did you tell me 1.6
million? 1.6
million,
yeah.
Plus, you've still got more to come, or more to try and come. Maybe not every community can even have the
courage
to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I of course there were naysayers in the community. Of course there were naysayers. Because what are you taking on that for? Of course.
Where are you going to get that money from?
Absolutely. Yeah. But everyone now, I think, are really, really appreciative of what's happened and how it's all worked out. Because it is a great asset for the village.
Just to help other people, what was the process? What did you have to do to go through bringing a community interest group together and going out to seek the funding, etc.? How did it all come about?
Well, I guess Braemar Community Limited was operating prior to the castle opportunity, so we had a mechanism, as it were, to take it over. And Bill Marshall, who's now dead, he was the founder member of Braemar Community Limited, and it was Bill who actually worked it through with the Farquharsons of Invercold that we would take on the castle, which was a very brave thing to do. But he shared it with the community and said, will we do it? And there was an enthusiasm. So the decision was made, and here we are.
And then to go out, I mean, where do you start? You've got this asset, but at the end of the day, if the roof's falling in and the harling's falling off and it's a danger, etc., it's not an asset, it's a liability. So where do you start? Where do you go to find funding, etc.?
Well, it's been hard work. Right through, constantly filling in funding applications. That's just all part of it. And, you know, the money has trickled in over the years, but for this project, because the project is funded by Heritage Lottery, and part of that is the education element, so we have got to provide educational experiences as part of the project. So they've been really, really supportive in everything that we've done, so it's been really helpful to have an organisation like that, as well as Historic Scotland, obviously, behind us.
So, you know, for other communities that are looking at bodies like that, you've got some expertise now in how to go about it. Maybe pick up the phone and speak to you.
We would really, we would be very, very happy to share our experiences with anyone.
Yeah. It's a massive achievement. The experiences, and then to raise the money, that money, to do this.
Yeah.
You know, you have to take your hat. I have to take your hat off, and I hope other communities listening to this, we might think, actually, A, I'm inspired, but B, there's a body that we could speak to.
How does it make you feel standing here watching the work progressing?
Well, it's fantastic. You know, my mum came from Aberdeen, and she married my dad, who came from Braemar. And when she first came to the village, she worked as a cook in the castle. But the castle, growing up in the village, the castle was nothing to do with Usgav. Yeah. It really wasn't, because it belonged to the Farquharsons of Invercold. It was used as a private house, nothing to do with us. And I think, oh my goodness me, my mum would be so thrilled to see how it has progressed and changed, and how the community are now looking after the castle. So that's fabulous.
And now you've got, you know, all the hard work that's gone into it, you've got a structurally sound, wind and watertight, safe building.
Yes, and it looks splendid.
And it looks splendid. Get that scaffolding down and it's going to look fantastic.
Yes, there's also a new interpretation centre to go in between the curtain wall and the castle itself. So that's going to be a fantastic new resource for the team presenting the castle to the public. I use the phrase curtain wall, it's a strange one, it catches people out. We now think of curtain walling as being what you put on office blocks, but traditionally a curtain wall is the battlement wall around the outside of the castle. There's very few in Scotland with intact battlement walls around the tower. You see these lone towers standing in the countryside, but the battlement walls are relatively rare to be so complete in Scotland. So it's a wonderful feature. If you go on holiday to the north of Spain, south of France, you see dozens of castles with these zigzag walls round the outside. This is a bit of that in Scotland.
It's quite special then. So what? Just on that, why is the wall still standing?
Because it's an active fortification. The Hanoverian army set themselves up and restored the castle. It was burnt down during the various Jacobite uprisings and battles, and the castle was put to the torch and burned down, and the whole upper section of the castle was lost. And it was the Hanoverian army being stationed there that rebuilt it and saved it for us. It wouldn't be there today. It would just be another lump of stone in the countryside.
So other castles that don't have the wall, don't have that, is because it's all falling into disrepair, and then it wasn't needed, whereas that was needed as a barracks, basically.
Yes, it's on a core junction in Highland life. That the road running east to west, meeting the road that runs north up through Glenshee, was a key junction. And although the castle is 400 years old, almost, there is almost certain to have been a defensive structure on that mound for many years before that. It's a key location, and given the infrastructure that was being built around that time in terms of roads around Scotland, military roads primarily, then that was a good spot to have a castle. And rather than start from scratch, why not use one that's half built?
You're very kind of knowledgeable about all of this. Apart from the, you know, professionally and the architectural part of it, being involved in this has obviously been very interesting for you personally.
Oh, I'm fascinated by it. I came late to the project. Susan Burness is our project architect for the job, and along with Ian Davidson did all the background research. I just get to read about it, which is fascinating because it's always lovely to read about something that you're actually engaged and working on. It brings history to life when you actually get to read a bit of history, slot it together with your general knowledge of the Jacobite rebellions, and you think, oh, so that slots into that battle, and Bonnie Dundee comes into the story, and you think, oh yes, I know a little bit about that. And suddenly, one project you work on brings all these strands together over a life of 400 years. It has to intersect with various different stories in Scottish histories.
And with all that history and all that going on here at Braemar, no wonder it's important to save it. No wonder it's going to be an attraction for visitors. You know, it's going to look fantastic, but what an attraction and what a place to tell some story of Scotland.
Yes, well, we're very lucky. The building, although it desperately needed repaired, it had never been neglected completely, or not for many years. It was in comparatively good order, and therefore we are just preserving it. There's restoration work, yes, with the render, but it's more about preserving it, making sure that it'll last another 100 years, not dragging it back from the brink. We deal with buildings on the at-risk register, and that's a whole different scale of work. This one, although it was a hugely challenging amount of money to raise, it was well worth the effort because you could see that you weren't just saving it from destruction, you were leaving something that would live and breathe and last another 100 years, not just save it from dying for another 20. This building's got a lot of life left in it, which, oh, when you walk away from it, that's great. That's a wonderful feeling.
Well done. Well done. Yeah. That was great to hear from Doreen, Stephen and Ian. There's no question in my mind that there's a real lesson in Braemar for any rural areas and communities looking to renew and make the most of their historical assets, and to use those assets to raise revenues for local community funds. We are back in Braemar for our episode next time. One of the outbuildings at the castle has a requirement for a thatched roof, and not just with any thatch, but heather. So, with the Bell Ingram team and some expert thatchers, we'll be finding out all about that traditional craft. Before I leave you, our usual quick reminder to finish up. On Farm is made by our team here at Seen and Heard PR and Marketing. Give us a shout. You might even bump into us at one of the summer shows coming up. If you have any comms or marketing questions relating to your food or rural business. So with that's it from me, and bye for now.